Away, Harper saw a couple of teenage boys in the kitchen plunging dishes into soapy water by the light of an oil lamp. But Norma had reserved some pasta in a steel warming pan and a couple of ladles of sauce. There was coffee and a can of condensed milk for cream. We had sugar for a while, and it was full of ants. Ants in the coffee, ants in the muffins, ants in the peach cobbler, Carol said. For a few weeks, ants were my primary source of protein. No sugar now, though. Just syrup. Sorry. Welcome to the last days. The sugar is gone and the milk will follow, Norma said. I put out 2 cans of milk for the coffee, but there's only 1 left. The other got used up? Carol asked. So quickly? Nope. Stole. I'm sure no one stole a can of milk. Stole, Norma repeated, her tone of voice closer to satisfaction than outrage. She sat behind the counter, occupied with a pair of silver knitting needles that raced back and forth, clicking and clacking, all the time she spoke. She was working on a giant shapeless tube of black yarn that might have been a prophylactic for King Kong. Harper and Carol made their way to Michael's table, Carol making a come-on-over gesture to Renee and the old fella. Sit with us, you two. We can all share, Harper. There's enough to go around. They arranged themselves around the table, bumping knees. Harper lifted her hand for her fork, but Carol grasped her fingers before she could reach it. Before we eat, we go around the circle and say one thing we're glad for, Carol said, leaning into Harper and speaking in a confidential tone of voice. Sometimes it's the best part of the meal, which will make more sense after you've tried the food.
We snacked already, but I don't mind bowing the head with you, said the old man, who hadn't yet been introduced.
Renee squeezed Harper's other hand, and then they were all sitting in a ring, leaning in toward the light of a single candle, like a group assembled for a séance. I'll start us off, Carol said. I'm glad for the woman sitting next to me, who saved my nephew when he had appendicitis. I'm glad she's here, and I have a chance to show her how grateful I am. I'm glad for her baby, because babies are exciting, like fat little sausages with faces.
The old fella spoke with lowered head and half-shut eyes. I'm glad for the nurse myself, because 124 people need a lot of looking after, and I've been over my head for months. I'm all this camp's had for medical care since the end of August, and all I know is what I learned in the Navy. I don't want to say how long it's been since I studied as a hospital corpsman, but at the time, they had only just phased out the use of leeches.
Me? I guess I'm mostly just glad to be in a place where people love me, Michael told them. People like Aunt Carol and Father Story. I'd do anything for them to keep this place safe. I lost one family. I'd rather die myself than lose another.
I'm glad to have had a hot lunch, Renee said, even if it was fried spam and ragu. I'm also glad this camp has an ace fisherman in Don Lewiston, and I'll be gladder still the next time it's my turn for fish,
nodding at the old fella.
Then she looked sidelong at Harper and said, And I'm so glad to see my friend from Portsmouth Hospital, who marched around 18 hours a day, whistling Disney tunes and trying to keep up the spirits of 1,000 sick and terrified patients. Every time she came in the room, it felt like a break in a month of clouds. She made me want to keep going when there wasn't any other reason.
Harper wasn't sure she'd be able to find her own voice, was ambushed by unexpected emotion. In her days at Portsmouth Hospital, she had felt about as useful as Renee's potted mint, and it caught her unprepared to hear someone tell her differently. Finally, she managed, I'm just glad not to be alone anymore.
Carol squeezed her fingers.
I am so glad to be part of this circle. We are all voices in the same chorus, and we sing our thanks. And for a moment it was there again. Carol's eyes pulsed with brightness, her irises becoming rings of fey green light.
Michael's eyes flashed as well, and Harper saw a prickle of red and gold flicker across the whorls of dragon scale on his bare arms.
Harper let go of Carol's hand as if at a physical shock, but then the weird sheen was gone, and Carol was eyeing her mischievously. Freaked you out, didn't I? Sorry. You'll get used to it, though. Eventually, it'll happen to you, too.
It's a little frightening, Harper said.
But also, well, like magic.
It's not magic. It's a miracle, Carol said,
like someone identifying the make of their new car. It's a Miata.
What's happening when you shine like that? Harper asked.
Something came back to her then, and she looked almost accusingly at Renee.
It's the same thing that happened to you in the hospital. You ran out covered in light. Everyone thought you were going to explode.
So did I, Renee said. I stumbled onto it by accident. They call it joining the bright.
Michael said, or the network, but I guess that's only people my age. A lot of my friends joke that it's just another social network, only they're kind of not joking.
You probably understand that the dragon scale responds badly to stress, Carol said.
The old fella, Don Lewiston, laughed. That's one way of putting it.
That's because it feels what you feel, Carol continued. That's such a powerful concept. I'm surprised more people haven't followed the thread of that idea to see where it goes. If you can create a feeling of security and well-being and acceptance, the dragon scale will react in a very different way, by making you feel more alive than you've ever felt before. It will make colors deeper and tastes richer and emotions stronger. It's like being set on fire with happiness. And you don't just feel your happiness. You feel everyone else's, too. Everyone around you, like we're all notes being played together in a single perfect chord.
And you don't burn, Michael said, twisting the orange coil of his beard.
And you don't burn, Carol repeated.
It doesn't seem possible, Harper said. How does it work?
Harmony, Carol said.
Harmony?
Connection, anyway, Renee said. Strong social connection. John has some interesting theories about it, if you can draw him out.
He told me once...
Carol's face darkened. An artery, squiggling in her right temple, thickened.
John Rookwood isn't here, and he doesn't want to be here. He prefers to keep his distance. It's easier to maintain his own personal myth that way. I think he looks down on us, honestly.
Do you really think that? Renee asked. I've never had that impression. I would have said he looks out for us. If he does have a condescending view of camp, he has a peculiar way of showing it. He's the person who led most of us here in the first place.
There was an uneasy silence. Renee gazed at Carol with an innocent curiosity. For her part, Carol would not meet her stare. Instead, she took a long swallow of coffee, a benign, easygoing gesture that Harper saw through. For an instant, there had been hate in her face.
John had made it clear the night before, in the woods, that he was no fan of Carol's story.
The feeling, it seemed, was mutual.
Michael was the first to speak and smooth over the awkward moment. The easiest way to join the Bright is to sing. The whole mess of us, the entire camp, get together in church every day after breakfast and have a big sing, and we always shine. You'll shine too. It might not happen right away, but stick with it. When it comes over you, it's like someone plugged you into a giant battery. It's like all the lights are turning on in your soul for the first time in your life.
His eyes had a bright, hot look that made Harper want to check him for fever.
I had no idea what was happening to me the first time I went into the Bright, Renee said. To say I was surprised doesn't do it justice, Mrs. Grayson.
You better start calling me Harper, Harper said. She didn't add that she thought she was all done being Mrs. Grayson.
That name belonged to Jacob, and she felt she had left everything of Jacob's behind in the woods. Her maiden name had been Willows. She missed the way it rolled off her tongue, and the thought of having her old name returned to her felt like another escape, a far more satisfying and peaceful escape than her leap out the bedroom window.
Harper, Renee said, trying it out. She smiled. I don't know if I'll be able to get used to it, but I'll try. Well, Harper, I was reading to the children. We were working our way through Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and I stopped to sing the Candyman song from the film. A few of them knew the words and sang along with me. It was such a nice, peaceful moment. I forgot we were all sick. I got that melty, tranced-out feeling that comes over you when you're in front of a fire and you've had a couple of drinks. And suddenly the kids began screaming. Time began to run thick and slow. I remember one of the children knocked my potted mint off my little end table, and it seemed like I had half an hour to reach out and catch it. And when I did, I realized my whole arm was splattered with light. I thought it was so glorious looking, I couldn't find it in me to be terrified. But then someone shrieked,
Get away from her. She's going to explode. And right away I thought, I am. I'm going to go off like a grenade. Sometimes I think people are a bit more suggestible when they enter that state. The bright. So I ran for my life with my potted mint. Straight past two sets of guards and half a dozen doctors and nurses, across the parking lot, and into the meadow south of the hospital. I thought I would set the grass on fire when I waded into it, but I didn't. It took a while for the light to die out, and afterwards I was shivery and drunk.
Drunk?
Oh, yeah, said Don Lewiston. You wind up pretty pickled after you go into the bright, especially the first couple of times. You forget your own name.
You what?
Carol said. A lot of people forget their own name the first time. I think that's the most beautiful part of it. All the stuff you think defines you, it peels off like Christmas wrapping. The bright winnows you down to your truest, best self, the version of you that goes deeper than a name or what football team you root for. And you become aware of yourself as just one leaf on a tree, and everyone you know and love, they're all the other leaves. A willow, Harper Willows thought, and shivered.
First time I ever joined the chorus, Don Lewiston said. I forgot the face of my father, the sound of my mother's voice, and the name of the ship I spent the last 20 years on. I wanted to kiss everyone I saw. Oh, and I got real goddamn generous. I remember this was in chapel, after a good hard sing. I was sitting next to a couple of young fellas, and I was just bursting to tell them how much I loved them, and all I could think to do was take off my boots and try to give them away. One boot for each of them, so they'd always have something to remember me by. They laughed at me, like grown-ups having a yuck at some kid who just drank his first beer.
Why didn't you come back to the hospital? Harper asked Renee. After you went bright.
At first it never occurred to me. I was just too out of my right mind. I was still holding my mint, and it came to me that it didn't belong in a pot, that it was cruel to keep it in a pot. I was ashamed of myself for all the months I had held it prisoner. I drifted deep into the woods and had myself a nice, quiet planting ceremony. Then I sat with my mint, with my face turned up to the sun, feeling about as content as I've ever felt in my life. I believe I thought I was going to photosynthesize along with my plant. At some point I heard a branch snap and opened my eyes, and there was Captain America and Tony the Tiger. And you know what? I wasn't the least surprised to see them. A superhero and a tiger boy just seemed like the next logical part of my day.
Allie, Harper said, and Nick. Nick, what about Nick? How can he join your sing-alongs and shine with the rest of you if he can't hear?
The others looked at one another and erupted into happy laughter, as if Harper had said something quite witty.
Nick, Carol said, is a natural. He could shine before I could. Why, though? Why it's so easy for him to join the bright? That's a question not one of us can answer. Nick says just because he can't hear music doesn't mean the dragon scale can't. My dad says it's another miracle. He's a great believer in miracles. So am I guess. Come on, Harper. I want to show you the rest of the camp.
If you want a crutch, Michael said, I have a shoulder.
On their way out, they stopped to put their dishes in a bin of gray, soapy water, and Harper glanced at the two teenage boys working in the kitchen. They were drying glasses by hand while listening to a radio. It was tuned to static. 5. The kids were chasing a soccer ball in the valley again, the eerie pale green ball racing this way and that, like a will-o'-the-wisp on crack. I don't know how we'll wear them out when it snows, Carol said.
What happens when it snows?
Mr. Patchett says we'll have to be more careful about our movements outside, Michael told her. If we leave tracks, someone could see them from the air. There isn't one part of winter I'm looking forward to.
When did you come to camp, Michael? Harper asked.
After my sisters burned to death, he said, without any trace of distress. They burned together. They were still holding each other after I put them out. That's a blessing, I think. They didn't die alone. They had each other for comfort. They're gone from this world, but I hear them whispering to me in the bright.
Carol said, sometimes when I'm in the bright, I would swear I feel my sister standing right next to me, close enough so I could lay my head on her shoulder, like I used to. When we shine, they all come back to us, you know. The light we make together shows everything that was ever lost to darkness. Harper clamped down on a shutter. When they spoke of the bright, they had all the uncomplicated happiness of pod people. Carol led Harper into the garden of towering monoliths and pagan stone altars. There's a rumor these rocks are thousands of years old, and were placed here by an ancient tribe with the help of alien technology. My father says they were hauled here from the quarry in Ogunquit, though, which is why it's better never to ask him about anything really interesting. When Harper was in among the stones, she could see brass plaques screwed into the towering pillars of granite. One listed the names of 17 boys who had died in the mud of eastern France during the First World War. Another listed the names of 34 boys who had died on the beaches of western France during the Second. Harper thought all tombstones should be this size, that the small blocks to be found in most graveyards did not even begin to express the sickening enormity of losing a virgin son thousands of miles away in the muck and cold. You needed something so big, you felt it might topple over and crush you. "This is our church," Carol told her. "If you go up in the steeple on a clear day, you can see into Maine. Only you don't want to look at Maine. There's nothing up north except for black smoke and lightning. In the mornings we come to sing and share the bright, and usually my dad will say a few words. After, it serves as a schoolroom." Carol pointed at a path tunneling through sumac and firs. "I live back there, through the woods, in a little white house with the big black star on it. I stay with my dad. I feel guilty about that sometimes. I should probably stay with all the other women in the girls' dorm. That's where we're going next. My dad says I can move out any time if I want to be with the other women. But I know if I left, he wouldn't ever sleep. He'd drink too much coffee and worry and pace around and worry more. He only sleeps about 5 hours as it is, and I have to make him take a pill to do that. Come on, let me show you where I keep my harem." Carol led her around to the back of the chapel, where four stone steps descended into a hole the rough size, shape, and depth of a grave. At the bottom of the pit was an old door on rusted hinges, half open to look into the cellar. "You'll have to manage without us from here," Michael said, nodding to Don. "We're not allowed." "It's no place for two strapping young boys like us," Don Lewiston said. "All of them women undressing you with their eyes, plotting ways to use you to satisfy their repressed needs. Makes a decent man feel lucky to escape with his life and virginity intact." Michael lowered his head, a blush darkening his pale features. Don laughed. Carol shook her head and clucked her tongue. "Michael Martin Lindquist, Jr., you are just too much fun to embarrass." Renee said to Harper, "If you don't have any garter belts, you can borrow a few of mine. One of the rules of the girls' dorm, no clothes allowed except for French underwear, corsets, and so on." "I am not listening to any of you," Michael said. "I am saving myself for marriage." He foisted Harper off on Carol and marched briskly away at something very close to a run. Don Lewiston strolled after him, hands in his pockets, whistling Spanish Ladies. Carol helped Harper make her way below. There were more steps on the other side of the door, descending deeper into the hill. The room beneath the chapel was a single enormous space, the ceiling supported by whitewashed brick pillars. Camp cots made a knee-high maze across the pitted cement floor. Close to 30 women were hanging around, sitting on their beds, or standing by a folding table set up against the back wall where there was a Mr. Coffee. Michael and Don could, in fact, have safely descended the steps without fear of finding themselves in a silken garden of delights. The room had an unsexy smell of damp and mothballs, and most of the girls had the waxen look of people who had not seen daylight for a long time. No garter belts in sight, but a lot of wet socks hung over pipes to steam dry. The prevailing fashion was Salvation Army chic. There was a double-sided chalkboard close to the foot of the steps, the sort of thing sandwich shops stood on the sidewalk to advertise the day's specials. Harper paused to see what was written on it, in bright chalk and girlish lettering. "House rules. No cell phones ever. Your cell phone should have been turned into a lookout. See something, hear something, say something. Everyone has a job to do. Know yours. Food, beverages, and medical supplies belong to everyone. No hoarding. No going outside in the daylight. Listen to the lookouts. It could save your life. Don't leave camp without talking to a lookout first. Weapons are strictly forbidden. So are secrets. Safety is everyone's business. Act like everyone depends on you. They do.
Quick, Carol said. What's your favorite song, celebrity crush, and the name of your first pet?
Harper said, You've got a friend in me, Ewan McGregor, mostly for Moulin Rouge, and my first pet was a schnauzer named Bert, because he was soot black and made me think of the chimney sweeps in Mary Poppins.
Carol stood up on a chair and cleared her throat and waved an arm over her head to get the attention of the room.
Hey, everybody. This is Harper. She's our new nurse. You've got a friend in me, Ewan McGregor, and a schnauzer named Bert. Let's have a big cheer for Nurse Harper.
This was met by a mix of hooting, applause, and halloos.
Allie Story threw a bra at Harper's head. Someone else yelled, Harper what?
Carol opened her mouth to reply, but Harper spoke first.
Willows, she called out. Harper Willows.
And to herself, in a lower voice, she said, Again, it seems. Carol led Harper on a winding path among the beds, to a neatly made cot near the center of the room. Harper's carpet bag had been set upon the pillow. Harper unbuckled it and peeked inside. Her clothes had been picked up and put in neat stacks. The portable mother rested on top of all. Harper folded her temporary cat and put it inside the cover, her child's first pet.
I should thank Mr. Rookwood for collecting my things, Harper said, remembering only after the words were out of her mouth that the fireman seemed to be Carol Story's least favorite subject.
It was too late, though, so in a casual, offhand tone, she finished, Where would I find him?
There was no look of contempt or anger this time. Instead, Carol regarded her with a mild, almost bland expression, then punched her softly in the arm. Come on outside again. I'll show you.
Even with Carol's help, Harper's ankle was twanging painfully by the time they mounted the steps into the night. The temperature had dropped. The air had texture now, a thousand fine quivering grains of almost rain blowing in off the ocean. They stood alone at the rear northeastern corner of the chapel. Carol pointed over the soccer field, the pines, and the boathouse below. Out in the surging blackness of the water was a darker blackness. A small island.
He's out there, she said. John Rookwood. He doesn't come to church. He doesn't eat with us. He keeps to himself.
What's he doing there?
I don't know. It's a secret.
It's his secret.
He never leaves the island for long, and no one knows why. You hear different stories.
She died out there, you know.
My sister. She burned to death and almost took Nick with her. Maybe John is out there mourning her. Maybe he's doing penance. Maybe he just likes being mysterious.
Penance? Does he blame himself somehow?
I'm sure, Carol said, and although her face was carefully composed, Harper once again heard an edge, a razor wire of emotion. Not that it's his fault. He wasn't on the island when it happened. No, my sister didn't need any help to kill herself. She managed that just fine on her own.
Carol gave Harper a sidelong look and said, But I'll tell you what, I won't let the kids go out there anymore, Nick and Allie. I think John understands. You might not want to make a habit of dropping in for social visits yourself.
People who get too close to John have a way of going down in flames.
6. After a breakfast of soft, milky oatmeal and bitter coffee, it was time for services. Ben Patchett was her crutch again and helped her along, out into the unseasonably warm October night. Dragonflies whisked through the perfumed dark. The buzz of excitement and pleasure, rising from the crowd around her, brought to mind small country carnivals, Ferris wheels, and fried dough. They filed into the narrow, high-ceilinged chapel, beneath splintery, exposed rafters. The nave was a long cabinet of shadows, windows boarded up against the night, the enormous space lit by just a few candles. Giant shadows twitched restlessly against the walls, more distinct than the people that threw them.
Harper had an arm across Ben Patchett's shoulder as he led her to a pew midway up the aisle. Another man squeezed in on her right side, a small, tubby fellow, a little older than Ben, with pink cheeks and the smooth complexion of an infant. Ben introduced him as Nelson Heinrich, who in a former life had owned a shop called Christmas Mart, which perhaps explained why he was wearing a sweater with reindeer on it when it was just turning Halloween. The merry chatter died as Father Story stepped to the podium. He moved his spectacles up his nose and peered owlishly at his own songbook, then announced, "If you'll open to page 332, we begin tonight with a plain but honorable hymn, beloved by the pilgrims in the early days of America." This was met by a smattering of laughs, although Harper didn't understand why until Nelson opened the songbook to the right place. It was a camp songbook for little boys and girls, not a true hymnal, and the song on page 332 turned out to be "Holly Holy" by Neil Diamond. Harper approved. If anyone could save her soul, it was probably him. Carol rose from the bench behind the organ and came to the front of the stage. She lifted her ukulele to acknowledge a little flurry of applause. Nelson bent toward Harper's ear and rather loudly said, "It's easy. You'll see. Nothing to it. Just lay back and enjoy it." An unfortunate statement with unfortunate connotations, Harper thought. Ben winced, then added, "It doesn't always come right away. Don't worry if nothing happens to you tonight. It would be amazing if anything did, like bowling a strike the first time you pick up a..." But he didn't have a chance to finish. Carol began to play, belting out that melody that sounded as much like a marching song as a gospel. When they all began to sing, over 100 voices resonating in the gloom, a pigeon was startled off one of the rafters above. Allie and Nick were in the row directly ahead of her, and the first Harper knew anything was happening was when the boy turned his head and smiled at her, and his normally aquamarine eyes were rings of gold light. Wires of dragon scale on the back of Ben Patchett's hand lit up like fiber-optic threads filling with brightness. A glow built from all directions, overpowering the dim red illumination of the candles. Harper thought of an atomic flash rising in a desert. The sound of the song mounted along with the light, until Harper could hear all those voices in her chest. On stage, Carol's belted white gown was rendered diaphanous, the body beneath painted with light. She didn't seem to mind or notice. Harper thought helplessly of the hallucinatory nudes who pirouetted through the credits of the James Bond movies. Harper felt she was being swallowed by all their noise. The brightness was not beautiful, but awful, like being caught in headlights hurtling madly toward her. Ben had an arm around her waist and was unconsciously kneading her hip, a gesture she found revolting but could not seem to break away from. She glanced at Nelson and found him wearing a choker of light. When he opened his mouth to bellow out the next line, Harper saw his tongue glowing a toxic shade of green. She wondered whether, if she began to scream, anyone would hear her over all the other voices. Not that she was going to scream. She had lost her breath, could not even sing. If not for her fractured ankle, she might have run. The only thing that got her to the end of the song was Renee and Don Lewiston. They were across the aisle and a little closer to the stage, but Harper could see them through a gap in the crowd. Renee's head was turned to look back at her, and she smiled sympathetically. The loops of scale around her neck shone, but it was a faded sort of glow, and the light had not reached her kind, clear eyes. More important, she was still there, still present, paying attention. And that was when Harper understood what so unnerved her about the others. In some way, Ben and Nelson, Allie and Nick, and all the rest of them had left the room, leaving behind lamps made of human skin. Thought had been replaced by light, and personality by harmony. But Renee, at least, was still there, and so was Don Lewiston, who sang dutifully, but did not glow at all. Later, Harper learned that Don was only sometimes able to shine with the others. When he turned on intensely, but more often he was completely untouched by their song. Don said it was because he had a tin ear, but Harper was unconvinced. His rumbling, rough bass was perfectly in tune, and he sang with a casual, disinterested confidence. Harper smiled weakly for Renee, but felt unsteady and sick. She had to close her eyes to withstand the assault of the last thunderous verse. Her dragon scale crawled unpleasantly, and the only thought she could manage was, "Stop! Stop! Stop!" And when it was over, and the room erupted into stamping feet and whistles and applause, it was all she could do not to cry. Ben absently stroked her hip. She was sure he didn't know he was doing it. The threads of light on his exposed scale were fading, but a brassy sheen remained in his eyes. He regarded her with affection, but not much recognition.
"Nothing?"
he asked. His voice had a drifting, musical quality, as if he had just woken from a restorative nap. "No luck? I wasn't paying attention. Kind of lost myself for a minute there." "No luck," Harper said. "It might be my ankle. It's been achy all morning, and it's a little distracting. Maybe I'll just sit for the next song and rest it." And she did sit the next time. She sat and closed her eyes to shut out the bright glare that so felt like oncoming headlights. She sat and waited to be run down. November 7. Harper woke the night of Thanksgiving from a dream about Jacob and Desolation's plow. She smelled smoke and couldn't figure out what was burning, and then she realized it was her. Harper wasn't in flames, but the stripe across her throat had charred the collar of her Coldplay t-shirt, causing it to blacken and smoke. Beneath the shirt, she felt a sensation like bug spray on a scrape, only all over. She threw aside her sheets with a cry and yanked off her shirt. The stripe marked her skin in inky lines flecked with grains of poisonous red light. The jellyfish sting intensified, made thought impossible. The sound that went up all around her, from the other women stirring in their beds, made her think uncharitably of pigeons startled into flight, a nervous cooing. Then Allie was with her. Allie put her legs around Harper's waist and clasped her from behind. She sang in a soft, barely audible whisper, lips close to Harper's ear. In the next moment, Renee was beside her, holding her hand in the dark, lacing her fingers through Harper's. Renee said, "You're not going to burn. No one burns here. That's one of the rules. You want to break the rules and get us all in trouble with Carol's story? Deep breaths, Nurse Willows. Big, deep breaths. With me now. In. Out. In." And Allie sang that old Oasis song. She sang that Harper was her wonderwall in a sweet, unafraid voice. She even did it in her fireman voice, in a darling, faux-snotty English accent of the sort best known as Mockney. Harper didn't start to cry until the dragon scale dimmed and went out and the pain began to pass. It left behind an achy, sunburnt feeling all through the spore. Allie stopped singing, but went on holding her. Her bony chin rested comfortably on Harper's shoulder. Renee rubbed her thumb over Harper's knuckles in a loving, motherly way. Nick Story stood in the dark, 4 paces from Harper's cot, watching her uneasily. Nick was the only boy who slept in the girls' dorm, splitting a cot with his big sister. He clutched a slide whistle to his chest with one hand. He couldn't hear it, but he knew it could blow through it and call the firemen. And what good would that do? Maybe the fireman would have brought a hose to douse her ashes.
"Atta girl," Renee said. "You're okay. All over. Could have been worse."
"Could have been better, too," Allie said. "You just missed a perfectly good opportunity to toast an awful Coldplay t-shirt. If I ever spontaneously combust, I hope I'm holding a whole stack of their CDs."
Harper made sounds that might have been laughter, or might have been sobs. Even she wasn't sure. Maybe a bit of both. 8. Harper filed into the night in her singed Coldplay shirt, moving along toward the cafeteria and breakfast with all the rest of them. She walked without seeing where she was going, letting the human tide carry her along. A dream. A dream had almost killed her. She had never imagined that going to sleep might be as dangerous as a glass of wine with Jacob over a loaded gun. In the dream, she was enormously pregnant, so huge it was both horrible and comic. She was trying to run, but the best she could manage was a tragic, hilarious waddle. She was clutching Desolation's plow to her sore and swollen breasts, and the pages were sticky with blood. There were bloody handprints all over it. She had the confused idea that she had beaten Jacob to death with it, and now she had to hide the evidence. She was running across the road to bury it, as if it were a corpse. An icy wind sheared up the highway, caught the manuscript, and dashed it to the blacktop. Harper got down on the frozen asphalt, grabbing pages and trying to collect the manuscript there in the dark and the cold. In the logic of a dream, it was necessary not to lose a single page. She had gathered up about a third when a pair of headlights snapped on, 300 feet down the road. A 2-ton freightliner with a plow the size of an airplane wing was parked along the curb.
"Oh, you bitch," Jacob called from behind the wheel. "Do you know how hard I worked on that? Where is your respect for literature?"
The gears ground. The freightliner began to roll. Jacob flicked the beams to high, pinning her to the road with a blinding blue light. He accelerated, crunched up into second gear, the noise of the engine rising to a diesel scream, and the headlights were piercing her right through. The headlights were hot on her skin. The headlights were cooking her. Just remembering it made her dragon scale prickle with an unwholesome heat. She walked with her head down, so lost in her hopeless, dismal thoughts that she was startled when someone planted a cold, gentle kiss on her cheek. She looked up in time to be kissed again on her right eyelid. It was snowing. Great fat white flakes as big as feathers floated aimlessly down from the darkness. So soft and light, they barely seemed to be descending at all. She closed her eyes, opened her mouth, tasted a snowdrop. The cafeteria was steamy and smelled of seared spam and white gravy. Harper shuffled through a din of shouts, laughter, and clattering utensils. The children had made paper placemats shaped like turkeys and colored them in. All the kids were working as waiters that evening and wore pilgrim hats made out of construction paper. Renee steered Harper to one of the long tables and they sat down together. Ben Patchett glided in from the other side, bumping Harper's hip with his own as he settled on the bench.
"Did you want to sit with us, Ben?"
Renee asked, although he had already plopped himself down. In the last 3 weeks, Ben had developed a habit of hovering. When Harper walked toward a door, it seemed like he was always there to hold it open for her. If she was limping, he slipped up against her, unasked, to put an arm around her waist and serve as her crutch. His fat, warm hands reminded her of yeasty, uncooked dough. He was harmless, and he was trying to be useful, and she wanted to be grateful. But instead she found herself wearied by the sight of him.
"You okay, Harper?"
Ben narrowed his eyes at her. "You look flushed. Drink something." "I'm fine. I already had some water, and you wouldn't believe how much I'm peeing these days."
"I said drink."
He pushed a paper cup of cranberry juice at her.
"Dr. Ben's orders."
She took the cup and drank, mostly to shut him up. She knew he was kidding, trying to have fun with her in his clumsy way. But she found herself even more irritable with him than usual. It was no problem for him to join the Bright. Ben Patchett always lit right up in chapel, from the first chords Carol played on the pipe organ. He was never going to wake up burning. He didn't have to be afraid of going to sleep. Harper's bad dreams of being run down in the road didn't surprise her in the least. She felt trapped in the path of oncoming headlights at least once a day, when all the rest of them sang. More and more, she dreaded entering the chapel for services. She had been in camp all month and had not been able to join the Bright, not a single time. In chapel, she was the one dead bulb on the Christmas tree. She clenched her fists in her lap throughout each day's ceremony, a white-knuckled flyer gritting her teeth through a battering stretch of turbulence. Recently, even Ben had stopped reassuring her it was just a matter of time before she connected, before she plugged in, joined up, all those phrases that made it sound like a matter of getting online with some modem of the soul. When services were over and they all filed out, Harper saw people avoiding eye contact with her. Those who did meet her gaze did so with small, cramped, pitying smiles. There was a stir of commotion halfway across the room as Carol helped Father Story up onto a chair. He raised both hands for quiet smiling down at the almost full room and blinking through his gold-rimmed bifocals. He began in a mumbly, muffled sort of way, and then he reached into his mouth and plucked out a white stone. His audience responded with a rumble of adoring laughter. Someone, it sounded like Don Lewiston, shouted, "Hey, fodder, is that what's for dinner? Christ, the food in this joint is bad." Norma Held glowered in the direction of whoever had been yelling, then called out, "No snacking before meals, father." Father Story smiled and said, "I thought this being the day of Thanksgiving, I should say something before we dig in. You can put your hands together if you want, or hold hands with whoever is next to you, or tune me out and listen to the wind, as it suits you." Throats cleared and chair legs thumped. Ben Patchett took Harper's hand in his palm moist and doughy. Renee gave Harper a sidelong glance that was full of sardonic sympathy. "Look who has a boyfriend. Lucky you." And took the other hand. "All of us together are a chorus of praise, saved by song and light," Father Story began. "We are grateful to have this chance to come together in harmony, saved by our love for each other. We have so much to be thankful for. I know I am thankful for biscuits and white gravy. It smells great. We all sing our thanks for Norma Held, who busted her butt making this amazing Thanksgiving dinner with very limited supplies. We sing our thanks for the girls who sweated puddles assisting her in the kitchen. We sing for Renee Gilmanton, who helped the kids with their pilgrim hats and taught them how to be an ace waitstaff. We sing for John Rookwood, who isn't here tonight, but who miraculously provided us with the cocoa and marshmallows I'm not supposed to mention, because we don't want the kids to get excited." A shriek of happiness went up around the room, followed by an indulgent murmur of adult laughter. Father Story smiled, then shut his eyes. His brow furrowed in thought. "When we sing together, we sing for all the people who loved us but who aren't here tonight. We sing in memory of every minute we got to have with them. I lost a daughter, a beautiful, smart, funny, combative, difficult, inspiring daughter. And I couldn't miss her any more than I do. I know other people here feel just the same about the ones they lost. I sing for what I had with my Sarah. And when we raise our voices in harmony, I feel her still. I find her spirit in the bright. I hear her singing for me as I sing for her." The wind shrilled beneath the eaves. Someone took a choked breath. Harper could feel the silence in her nerve endings, a sweet, painful throb. Father Story opened his wet eyes and swept a grateful, affectionate look across the room. "The rest of us, we're still here, and it feels pretty good. One more night on Earth, with a little music and some fresh biscuits and some good conversation. That's about all I ever wanted. I don't know about anyone else. And now I think everyone would just about sing with joy if I'd shut up so we can get to eating." A cheer went up, a loud yell of pleasure, followed by applause. Don Lewiston stood. Then others were standing with him, pushing back their benches and chairs so they could clap for the old man, who told them it was all right to still sometimes be happy, even now. As Father Story came down out of his chair, they rose from theirs, whistling and clapping, and Harper whistled and clapped with them, glad for him. For one moment, anyway, she was not sick at heart about waking up to the smell of smoke. They ate greasy cubes of Spam, half-drowned in gravy, on top of floury, buttery biscuits. Harper didn't have any appetite at all and ate mechanically, and she was surprised when it was all gone and she was scraping the plate for the last of the gravy. She might not be hungry, but the baby was always in the mood for a little something. She looked at the half-biscuit on Renee's plate a moment too long, and the older woman smiled and used a plastic fork to shove it onto Harper's dish. "No," Harper said, "don't. I don't want it." "That would be more convincing if I didn't see you picking crumbs off the tablecloth and eating them." "Oh, God," Harper said, "I'm such a pig. It must be like sitting next to a fucking swine at the trough." Ben twitched and looked away. Harper was not a big one for swearing, but around him she couldn't help herself. Ben avoided profanity like a cat avoided getting wet. said heck for hell, crap for shit, and frick for fuck, a habit Harper found unpleasantly prissy. When she herself swore, it never failed to make him flinch. Sometimes, Harper thought he was more of an old lady than Norma held. She supposed she had been looking to pay him back ever since he decided to play daddy and make her drink her cranberry juice. No sooner had she done it, though, than she felt guilty. It was a lousy thing to do, set out to offend a guy who had never been anything but decent to her. He put his fork down and stood up. Harper felt a flash of horror, wondered if she had so offended him he was about to flee. But no, he was making his own announcement, climbing up onto the bench, putting two fingers in his mouth, and blowing an ear-splitting whistle. "I don't have a rock in my mouth," Ben said. "But by the time I'm done talking, some of you will probably wish I did." He smiled at this, but no one was quite sure whether to laugh or not, and the room remained silent except for a low, uneasy rustle of back chatter. "The snow may be pretty, but it's going to make our lives a whole lot harder. Up until now, we've had the freedom to go about camp as we like, and the kids have had plenty of room to run and play. I am sorry, but now all that has to change. Tonight, the lookouts will be setting out planks to create walkways between buildings. When you're passing between buildings, you must stay on the planks. If a quarantine patrol comes through here, and they find the snow all churned up with footprints, they are going to know people are hiding here. I want the lookouts to meet me in Monument Park after tonight's chapel. We need to practice getting the boards up and out of sight. I want to be able to make them disappear inside of 2 minutes. We can do this, but it isn't going to come easy, so expect to be out there for a while, and dress accordingly." This was met by groans, but Harper thought they were less than entirely heartfelt. The teenagers who had signed up to be lookouts loved hustling in the cold, pretending they were Marines on a black op. Most of them had been preparing for post-apocalyptic stealth missions since they were old enough to pick up an Xbox controller. "Father's story mentioned that Norma Hell just about killed herself pulling together today's meal. It wasn't easy, given what she has to work with. Which brings me to some unfortunate news. Norma and Carol and myself spent 6 hours in the kitchen yesterday, going over our supplies. I won't kid you. We're in a corner, and we've had to make some tough decisions. So starting on Monday next week, everyone between the ages of 13 and 60, who isn't infirm or pregnant..." Ben glanced down at Harper and winked. "We'll draw a ticket out of a hat just before lunch. If your ticket has an X on it, we'll ask you to skip that meal. On an average night, probably 30 people will miss out on their lunch. If you happen to lose in the Hunger Games..." He paused, smiling, expecting laughter. When he didn't get any, his face darkened, and he hurried on. "You can skip drawing a ticket at the next lunch. I'm sorry. It's simple math. This camp was outfitted with enough dry and canned goods to keep a couple hundred kids fed for a few months. We've had over 100 people here since July, and more turning up every week. The barrels are low, and there isn't going to be any more anytime soon." No one mock groaned this time. Instead, Harper heard nervous whispers and saw people casting worried looks back and forth. Allie, who was two tables away, turned to Michael, sitting beside her, raised a hand to cover her mouth, and began to hiss furiously into his ear. "Anyone who draws a losing ticket will still be offered coffee or tea, and as a thank you, well, Norma has discovered some sugar, a large can of it. It doesn't even have ants in it. So, if you pull a bad ticket, you can also have a teaspoon of sugar for whatever you're drinking. 1 teaspoon. It's not much, but it's something. It's the best we can do to show our gratitude." Ben's voice hardened, and he went on. "On the subject of low supplies and missing meals, someone is taking cans of condensed milk. Some of the spam has gone missing, too, and we don't have any to spare. That has to stop. It's not a joke. You are literally stealing food out of the mouths of children. And if someone took Emily Waterman's big teacup yesterday, I would be grateful if you would just put it back on her bed at some point. You don't have to explain yourself. Just do it. It's a very, very large teacup, about the size of a soup bowl, with stars printed in the bottom. It's her lucky cup of stars, and she's had it since she was tiny, and it means a lot to her. That's all. Thank you." He waited to see if anyone would applaud for him, but no one did, and finally Harper reached up and held his hot, damp hand while he climbed down. She wasn't annoyed with him anymore. Conversation returned to the room, but it was subdued and troubled. He sat poking his plastic fork at some smears of gravy on his plate. Renee leaned forward to look around Harper and said, "Are you all right, Ben?" "It was bad enough being the guy who took away the cell phones," Ben said. "Now I'm the guy who took away lunch. Oh, frick it." He pulled himself up off the bench, took his plate to the counter, and dumped it in a bin full of gray, soapy water. "I don't care if I miss lunches." Renee watched Ben turn up his collar and exit the cafeteria without a look back. "They were pretty terrible anyway, and I was hoping to lose 10 pounds. Of course, he's got it all wrong. People weren't angry at him when he took away the cell phones. They were glad. They were relieved someone was thinking about how to keep us all safe. They don't hold one single thing he's done against him. Not even what he did to Harold Cross. The only person who blames Ben Patchett for what happened to Harold is Ben Patchett."
"Harold Cross," Harper said. "I've heard that name before. Who's Harold Cross, and what did Ben do to him?" Renee blinked, staring at Harper in surprise.
"Shot him. You didn't know that? Shot him right in the throat."
9.
There were little triangles of coconut custard pie on a graham cracker crust for dessert, the best and sweetest thing Harper had eaten since she came to camp. She closed her eyes after each spoonful to better concentrate on the creamy taste of it. It was so good, she felt a little like crying, or at least writing Norma Held a sincere thank-you card. Renee was gone for a bit, helping to prepare cocoa for the children, and when she returned she had 2 mugs of black coffee and Don Lewiston and Allie's story in tow. Nick's story was there, too, trailing along in his big sister's wake. He carried a mug of hot chocolate before him, with a kind of reverence, not unlike a child bearing the wedding rings at a marriage.
"Are you all right?" Renee asked. "You're making a face."
"That's my orgasm face," Harper said, around her last bite of pie. "I don't think it's any accident that a slice of pie comes in the exact same shape as a slice of pussy," Allie said.
"Do you girls want to talk amongst yourselves?" Don asked. "I could come back another time. This conversation is heading in a direction that might be upsetting to the ears of an innocent like myself."
"You can sit down," Renee said, "and tell what happened to Harold Cross. I think Harper ought to know about it, and the both of you can tell it better than I can. Don, you worked with him. Allie, you knew him better than most, and you were both there at the end."
"I wouldn't say I knew him all that well. It got to a point where I couldn't even stand to be in the same room with him," Allie said.
"But you tried," Renee said. "You made an effort. There aren't many other people here who can say that."
Nick perched on the bench to Allie's left. He looked from Allie to Renee and back, then moved his hands in the air, asking something of his sister. Allie furrowed her brow and began to make minute gestures with her fingers.
"My mom was a lot better at sign," Allie said. "I'm only really confident about my finger spelling. He wants to know what we're talking about. One good thing about the little guy being deaf, we don't have to worry about him overhearing the really rotten bits and getting sad."
"And he doesn't read lips at all?" Harper asked.
"That's only in movies." Don sipped at his coffee and grimaced. "Tell you what, nothing will cure a case of feeling good faster than a sip of this coffee. Except maybe for talking about Harold Cross." He set his mug down. "Harold was pretty much always alone. Kind of a fat kid no one liked. Too smart for his own good, you understand? Smarter than everyone else and happy to let you know it. If you were digging a latrine, he'd tell you a better, more scientific way to do it. But he wouldn't pick up a shovel himself. Would say his back hurt or something. You know the type.
He wore this striped T-shirt and a pair of black denim shorts, and I never saw him wear anything else. He had a booger on that shirt once that was there for 3 days. Swear to Jesus," Allie said.
"I remember that booger," Don said. "He had that thing on his shirt so long, he should have given it a name."
Nick was still watching, and now he asked Allie something else, in a few slow, careful gestures. Allie's reply was faster this time, and involved a knuckle screwed into her nose, miming the act of digging for boogers.
Nick grinned. He dug a stub of pencil out of his jeans and wrote something on his turkey-shaped placemat. He pushed the mat across the table to Harper.
He'd get smoky sometimes, too. Not bad, but like if you throw a lot of wet moss on a campfire. Just a little nasty smoke coming out from under his shorts. Allie said it was coming from his butt chimney.
When Harper looked back, Nick had a hand clamped over his mouth and was making a thin, quavering whistle. He might lack the power of speech, but the giggles, it seemed, remained available even to the mute.
Renee said, "He was a former med student, and when I came to camp, he was in charge of the infirmary. I guess he was 24 years old, maybe 25. He went around with a little reporter's notebook, and sometimes he'd sit on a rock and start scribbling in it. I think that worried some people. You felt like he was taking notes on you."
Allie said, "Now and then one of the girls would try to snatch his notebook away to see what he was writing. That would get his dragon scale acting up, and he'd storm off in a haze, literally fuming, you know?"
"From the butt chimney," Don Lewiston said. And this time they all laughed, except for Nick, who had lost the thread and could only smile quizzically.
"The first time he joined the Bright, he lit up fast," Allie said. "Some people get it right away and some people don't. In Harold's case, it maybe came over him too quickly. He fell into the Bright so fast and hard, it scared him. He screamed and dropped to the floor and rolled around like he was burning. Later he said he didn't like how it felt, having other people in his head. Which doesn't really happen. It isn't telepathy. No one gets inside your head. It's just a good feeling, coming off the people around you. It's like being held, like the perfect hug. After that first time, Harold just about never lit up. He kept himself at a distance from the rest of us. He wasn't participating. He was just watching us."
"Yep, that's right," Don agreed. "Then one day, after he'd been in camp about 2 weeks, he stood up at the end of services and said he'd like to address the room. Kinda dumbstruck everyone. As a rule, if there's any talking to do in chapel, Father Story or Carol are the ones to do it. It was like watching a TV show, and suddenly one of the extras decides to deliver a speech ain't in the script."
"Father Story," Renee added. "God love that man. He just poked his thinking rock in his mouth and sat down to listen, like a student settling in for a lecture on his favorite subject."
Allie rasped a hand over the bristly curve of her head. "Harold told us we had a moral obligation to let the world know about our discovery. He said we didn't belong in hiding. He said we ought to be on cable news, that we ought to go public about what we could do. He said our process of subduing the dragon scale was of scientific interest, and there were lots of people who wanted to know more about us. Aunt Carol said, 'Harold, darling, what do you mean? Lots of people want to know about us.' And Harold said he had been texting with a doctor in Berkeley who thought our community might represent a real breakthrough. There was another doctor in Argentina who wanted Harold to take blood samples after a successful chorus. Harold said all this like it was no big deal. He didn't seem to have any idea what he had done."
"Oh, Harper, it was bad," Renee said. "That was a bad night."
"Mr. Patchett jumped up and asked how many people he'd been texting with, and if he'd been texting from inside camp. Mr. Patchett said tracing the location of a smartphone was the easiest thing in the world, and for all Harold knew, he was drawing a big X on the map for the local quarantine patrols. People started crying, grabbing their kids. We were like people on an airplane who have just heard from the pilot that there's a terrorist in the cockpit."
Allie's gaze came unfocused. She wasn't seeing Harper anymore, but was looking back into a summer night of alarm and commotion.
"Mr. Patchett made him give up his cell. He spent 3 minutes scrolling through Harold's texts. It turned out he had been in contact with 30 different people all over the country, all over the world, sending them photos, too, stuff that would make it easy to identify where we were hiding."
"Harold wanted the camp to have a vote," Don Lewiston put in. "Well, he got one, all right. Ben led a vote to confiscate every cell phone in camp, had Allie and Mikey collect them all in a great trash bag." "I didn't like what happened to Harold after that," Renee said. "If we ever did him wrong, it was then."
Allie nodded. "After the phones got taken away, it was like Harold was a poisonous bug, and the whole camp wanted to keep him under a jar where he couldn't sting anyone. Little kids started calling him Horrid instead of Harold. No one would sit with him in the cafeteria, except for Granddad, who can get along with anyone. Then one day,
One of the girls chucked a frisbee right in Harold's face and smashed his glasses. She pretended it was an accident, like she meant for him to catch it. But it was really shitty, and I told her it was shitty. I felt like someone had to try and stick up for him. I felt like it was bad for all of us not to care about him. So I helped fix his glasses, and I started sitting with him and Granddad at lunch. I signed up for chores with him.